This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Good evening, and welcome to The People Speak on BBS Radio. I'm your host, Samantha Legend. You can listen to the live stream of our show by calling 1-716-748-0144. Most of us have childhood dreams. However, few of us ever get to realize those dreams. But you were about to hear from a woman who did. Our guest tonight is Kate Howarth, the author of award-winning memoir, 10 Hail Marys, a shocking and compelling story of a 15-year-old unmarried girl who pitted herself against family, society, and the church to keep her baby at a time when most young women in her situation were forced to surrender their child for adoption. 10 Hail Marys is a remarkable story of courage and determination, survival and hope. Although at times shocking in her frankness, Howarth is never self-pitying or bitter. Nominated for a number of literary awards, 10 Hail Marys went on to win the Nonfiction Book of the Year in 2010. Welcome to The People Speak, Kate. I'd like to congratulate you for a great book. As a child, you dreamed of becoming a writer, but it wasn't until you were past 60 years of age that this dream became a reality. Before we discuss what motivated you to write the story, I'd like to know what kept your dream alive.
Hello, Samantha, and thank you and the producers and for the invitation to the show and also to your listeners for listening in. The answer to your question goes back to my childhood. Children of the 1950s were expected to be seen and not heard. And the adults around me were always using words I didn't understand but wouldn't have dared to ask. My first day at school, as you recall, was a shocker, and I learned that there were certain words I should never repeat. Learning the alphabet and creating words to put onto the page was like finding the Holy Grail for me, and pretty soon I was writing everything down, diarising my life in minute detail. Keeping diaries gave me a voice, even if I was the only person who heard it. I soon discovered that writing compositions at school would also give me praise and recognition for achievement, which was something I never got at home. I was about 12, I would think, when I decided that I wanted to be a writer. It was a lofty ambition at the time for a young Aboriginal girl. And when I was 14, and went to school one day and was told rather abruptly that I was being taken out of school, exempted due to family hardship. A week before the final exams that would help me get a cadetship into journalism, I was utterly devastated and stopped writing altogether. It wasn't until I found myself at St. Margaret's Home for Unwed Mothers when I was 15 that I started to keep diaries again. I had to believe that there was going to be a better future and that everything that was happening to me at the time had a purpose. I used to pray every night to the Virgin Mary and make promises that if I got through this, that someday I would do something to help others. Well, I did get through it, and it was that promise that eventually drove me to follow the path of becoming a writer.
And we're all grateful. The title of your book, 10 Hail Marys, was intriguing, but fits the narrative as well, very well. How did you come up with that title?
Well, I had the title long before the book was finished. The Hail Mary is a very special prayer for all Catholics. It's a prayer of penance and forgiveness, and it's also said after the confession of sins. Saying 10 Hail Marys or being given 10 Hail Marys by the priest to say after a confession meant your sins were pretty big. So that's where the title came from. But it also has a very personal meaning for me. It was the prayer that I said whenever I was in strife, which was pretty often when I was a kid, and for reasons I can't explain, my prayers were always answered, not always immediately, but eventually.
So are you a religious person?
No, I wouldn't call myself religious. If I had to put a title on myself, I'd say I'm a lapsed Catholic. Apparently there's a growing number of us out there who has retained a belief in prayer.
Well, I'd like to take a look at some of your childhood experiences that shaped the woman you are today. You were abandoned almost at birth by your mother. Meanwhile, the identity of your father remained a mystery. At 13, you were abandoned again by your grandmother, who left her youngest sons to fend for themselves, while you get sent to live with a neighbor. Then at 15, you become pregnant and go back to Mama, your grandmother, believing that she would help you. After all, she had been supportive to the other girls in the neighborhood in the similar situations.
Oh, yes. Mama was very good like that. She even knitted baby wear for some of the girls whom she referred to were up the duff. Expression used in those days. And I knew that Mama wouldn't be as accommodating to me, however, but I hadn't anticipated what she'd do. My initial fear was that I'd be forced to have an abortion. So I didn't tell her that I was pregnant until I knew I was too far gone for this to happen. Now, when I did, well, she actually realised I was pregnant. She could tell. Women can tell when a girl's pregnant. And so after she'd exhausted herself slapping me around, she cried in a room for 3 days and then came out and announced that I had to go to the nuns. I had absolutely no idea what that meant, and it wasn't until we arrived at St. Margaret's that I was handed the consent for adoption that I realised she was expecting me to give my baby away to a stranger. I'd never heard of such a thing, and I refused to sign the consent for adoption, and Mama left, perhaps expecting that the nuns would wear me down.
You're so strong. So strong. Let me say that from a reader's perspective. Huh?
Pig-headed, some might say.
No. Lovely. Let me say that from a reader's perspective, it is an incredible and very personal journey. I found myself empathizing with you in so many ways. Even before it was published, your book was shortlisted for a major writing award. That's extraordinary.
Yes, and that astounded me at the time. I'd been recommended to enter the manuscript in the Queensland Premier's Literary Awards for unpublished manuscripts. And I was shocked to receive news that I'd been shortlisted. And a few weeks later, I was advised that I didn't win the award, but I received an invitation to the awards ceremony. And I took my beautiful granddaughter, Kate, who was 12 at the time, to Queensland, and we had the most wonderful time. It was the first time she'd ever flown on an aeroplane, and we stayed in a beautiful hotel, and I let her hit the mini bar for chocolates and so on. So we had a ball. And I can't tell you what a special moment it was for me, sitting in that auditorium with Kate jumping up and down with excitement when she saw my name on the big screen. It was at the after party that I was approached by the University of Queensland Press regarding a contract to publish.
Incredible. So what motivated you to share such personal details and struggles?
Well, that can be summed up with one word, and that word is rage. In 2006, when life once again brought me to a standstill, and I got to read the final report from a New South Wales parliamentary inquiry titled Releasing the Past, that a friend had told me about 5 years earlier, when I learned about the whitewashing of this inquiry, and especially the evidence from Sister Antoinette Baldwin, the spokesperson for the Sisters of St. Joseph's, who ran St. Margaret's Home for unwed girls, I knew that I couldn't remain silent. At the time, not even my closest friends knew that I had a baby in those circumstances, and it was going to take a lot of courage and determination on my part to get the story told. I'd suppressed these events for over 40 years, and the thought of dredging them up and putting them out into a book for all to read was a pretty terrifying prospect, and for my own sake, I doubt whether I could have done it. But telling my story was going to blow the whistle on the lies told to the inquiry, with regard to how a young woman, me in particular, was treated when I refused to surrender the child for adoption and particularly expressed a desire to keep the child. The New South Wales inquiry said that they had not been able to locate one unmarried mother who kept the child of 150,000 children that were taken for adoption between 1950 and 1998. So it seemed that I might be the only person who could tell the story. The evidence from Sister Antoinette would have left every child born to a young unwed mother at St Margaret's believing that their mother gave them up for adoption, knowing that there were other options, and frankly, that was a blatant lie.
It's amazing.
I know that's a lot to take in, but so the rage, I was absolutely incensed to find all what they'd done.
I'm just kind of speechless that you have somebody that's, you know, a symbol of piety, that, you know, a sister, a nun, just not giving you the information for your child.
Let me get Sister Antoinette off the hook here a bit. Sister Antoinette was sent in as the spokesperson because she could only give anecdotal evidence. She wasn't at the hospital at the time of what was known as the bumper crop.
Okay.
Yeah, so she could only give anecdotal evidence. She couldn't actually be put on the spot, and she was able to you know, duck shove things by saying, well, anecdotally, we know this this was the policy, but I don't really know if this was the practice. So, yeah. So she wasn't actually a witness to. She wasn't involved with us girls at the home. She was in fact she was a prenatal nurse at the time and had nothing to do with us unmarried mothers. I didn't even know who she was until I saw her name on the inquiry evidence given at the inquiry. So it was just
a
blatant
lie. That's very kind of you. That's very kind of you.
Well, I like to be fair. You know, I don't want to put Sister Antoinette's neck in the noose. She was sent there to give this evidence because they knew that she was a very good spokesperson. She's a very strong, intelligent woman who'd worked in other ministries like education, so she could handle herself. But it was really a whitewashing. To send her in and she couldn't answer the questions, she should have just been sent away and said, and they tried to do that. Some of the people who were convening the inquiry said, look, can you go away and get someone who can answer our questions? Well, that never happened. Her evidence stood. And they were just lies, not lies that she told, but lies that the administration had were trying to put out.
Okay. You explained so well. In the preface of your book, you claim that adoption practices of the time were illegal. Was that proven to be true?
Well, yes, they were. It was. The National Senate inquiry, that was the second inquiry that ran from 2010, after the publication of my book, through to 2012, reaffirmed what had already been discovered in the first inquiry in New South Wales over a decade earlier, and that was that adoption practices at the time were not only unethical, but in most cases illegal. And perhaps this was overlooked at the first inquiry because it was too shocking for anyone to want to tackle this, especially as the Catholic Church were deeply implicated. Let me explain that prior to 1973 in Australia, it was generally assumed that there was no financial assistance for unwed mothers until the Whitlam government introduced the supporting parent benefit in 1973, when in fact, under the Child Adoption Act of 1939, financial and other material assistance was available to unmarried mothers and was paid under Section 21 of the widow's pension. Mm-hmm. And the law also at the time stated that consent for adoption could not be taken until 5 days after the birth of the child, and only then after the mother had been fully advised of the options available to her. There was also a revocation period of 30 days that was also kept hidden. Unmarried mothers that I knew at the home who'd signed the consent for adoption thought that was that. The door was closed, they surrendered their baby and they just tried to disconnect and were treated a little bit like battery hens, you know. They were carrying incubators, they were carrying a baby for someone else. And the Sisters of St. Joseph were not the only people that were breaking the law. All the other adoption agencies operating in the 1960s, not only did they break all the codes of common decency, but they did break the law to procure children for adoption. you know, to learn 40 years after the birth of my son that this financial assistance was available but kept hidden by what can only be described as a rapacious, profit-driven adoption industry hit me like I'd been struck with a blunt object. You know, had I known of the availability and other assistance at the time, my life and that of my son would have panned out quite differently. And yet, even today, I consider myself to be one of the fortunate, or the very fortunate. Unlike the 150,000 other young women in my situation, I didn't lose my son at birth. By telling my story, I hope to set the record straight and give a voice to those young girls who'd had their babies snatched from their wombs only to be labelled heartless sluts who didn't want the child. You know, even today, I come across people and commentators who help to perpetuate the myth that there was no support available for unmarried mothers prior to 1973. And this is perhaps because it's become so deeply embedded in our psyche, because it's too hard to comprehend that people would be as cruel and callous as to take a newborn from an unmarried mother without advising her of the options available to keep and raise the baby. If I may, Sam, if we have time, I'd like to read from the preface of the book so the listeners can hear some of the evidence that was given at the inquiry, which, as you'll discover, is totally at odds with my personal experience. Is that okay if I do a quick reading?
Oh, please do.
Okay, I'll just pick it up. I won't read. I'll just pick it up from the evidence here, taken, actually lifted out of the inquiry. So this is not my writing. This is straight off the pages of the inquiry, the transcripts of evidence from the adoption practice. It's available on the internet. And it says, "It is my understanding that if a mother expressed a wish to keep her baby or changed her mind about adoption, she would then receive the same treatment as any other mother who was keeping her child and was discharged from the hospital post-delivery. I understand that they were given some assistance. I don't know what form that assistance took. I understand it was practical help with baby clothes and equipment for the baby." For the end. Now, earlier in their submission to the inquiry, the Sisters of St. Joseph stated that between 1952 and 1966, girls who changed their minds could actually stay at the home for up to 6 to 12 months where they could have the baby cared for while they tried to find employment and accommodation. I nearly fell on the floor laughing when I read that section of the inquiry, but because that certainly wasn't my experience.
Well, I'm glad you're so strong. You know, in the preface, you mentioned that you hope to see a full national inquiry into these events to bring justice for the victims and an apology.
Well, that was the driving force behind telling the story, which at times left me feeling pretty gutted. It was as if I was undergoing an autopsy while still breathing. At the outset, I was hoping to help in the healing process of the young women and the children they lost, but as it turned out, the first person to be healed was me. For years I'd carried around the burden of guilt and shame, and going back and revisiting those events and realising that I was little more than a child myself, I was able to stop beating myself up so vigorously, and it was a very cathartic experience.
Yeah, that's the journaling and the whole facing up to everything that's happened to you in your life, and you just came full circle.
So, it took a while. It was a big circle. It didn't happen immediately.
Oh. So just 6 months after the publication of 10 Hail Marys in 2010, a full national Senate inquiry was called into what is now known as the forced adoption practices. Were you involved in this inquiry?
Yes, I was, and I also gave evidence at the inquiry, along with hundreds of women and some of the children that were taken from their mothers, who were encouraged to come forward and tell their harrowing stories. Let me mention here the work of Deanne Welfare and Lily Arthur, who formed Origins Inc., an organisation that is now started in Australia, but of course it's now in other countries around the world, particularly big in Canada. And it's an organisation dedicated to helping people who have been affected by adoption. And that includes children as well as other family members and the mother and whoever has been involved, and these practices have left harmed in any way. to help them rebuild their lives and understand the situation a little bit better, and more importantly, stop blaming themselves. It was due to the hard work and persistence of Deanne Welfare and Lily Arthur that brought about the first parliamentary inquiry in New South Wales in 1998. Following the death of Deanne in 2008, Lily carried on her work. In 2009, I tracked Lily down and told her that I was about to release a story that would challenge the evidence taken at the New South Wales inquiry that I hoped was going to kick up some dust and add a strong voice to the work she'd already started. Where my story was different lay in the fact that I was the only one, it seemed, who went through those homes, who could tell the story of the lengths they went to procure the consent for adoption. From a young mother who was determined to keep the child, the tactics they used were tantamount to torture.
What kind of things would they do?
Well, I hope you've got a strong stomach. You better tell your listeners if they're eating to stop eating. Now, I'll give you an example. After working 6.5 days a week in the laundry and kitchen without pay, on a diet that was hopelessly inadequate for pregnant girls, the hospital administrator, Sister Anne, would come to my bed in the middle of the night and shine a torch in my face, telling me that I was going to go to hell for being such a wicked girl. You have no means to support this child, she said. The decent thing would be to give the baby up to a wealthy couple who can give the child all the things you can't. This went on night after night for months. Things got so bad, my hair was falling out in clumps, and the frequent nosebleeds left me feeling anemic.
So they verbally attacked you, aiming at your self-confidence, left you undernourished, and worked you as a slave for 6.5 days a week while you were pregnant.
Yep, and I knew that was going to be pretty hard for the public to understand because this story hadn't been told in its detail. You know, at the parliamentary inquiry, Sister Baldwin said we were given, in quotes, light duties to pay for our keep and help to give us a feeling of, in quotes, self-worth. Well, Sam, I can tell you I didn't have any feelings of self-worth scooping up piles of fly-blown, bloodied sanitary napkins in the sweltering laundry or trying to reach the taps in the kitchen with my big belly in the way as I washed food scraps from the plates of hospital patients that was better than the food we were given to live on. I'm sorry, but I know that that's a pretty ugly scene, but that's exactly as it occurred.
Sorry.
Make your stomachs worm.
It's just a horrible visual, and the fact that you were actually touching these things. I mean,
yeah.
Okay. So for months you resist all the pressure to sign the consent for adoption, and on the day after Christmas in 1965, Sister Anne turns up the heat. I found myself just reeling with disbelief that the day that you were accused of being seen at the hotel across the street from the hospital. Yeah, can you take ludicrous. Listeners back to that time?
Yeah, it was quite ludicrous. I was 8 months pregnant. Look, I think the best way to – I'll just reach for the book because when I still hadn't signed the consent for adoption by Christmas, it was only 4 weeks away from my due date and Sister Anne had called me to her office. Uncle Stan and Shirley had come to visit me and they were looking pretty distressed, and I thought my brother might have been killed in Vietnam, and perhaps I'll read this section to you so you can just get the full impact of it because it was a pretty horrific thing. On Christmas Day, I'd had a visitor. I'd had Peter, an old boyfriend of mine, come to visit me, and that was strictly forbidden. You couldn't have male visitors who weren't relatives, and Sister Anne sprung me. Now, she didn't say anything to me at the time, but I was waiting in the afternoon for the bomb to drop, and to my surprise, nothing happened. The rest of the day was pretty peaceful. They even had a Christmas party to farewell one of the girls who'd had her baby and was going home, and she was very unhappy, and she came up to me with tears, and she said, "I wish I hadn't given my baby away, but it's too late," she said, and I wish I had your courage and didn't sign the consent. Now, I didn't know whether my refusal to give consent was courage or, as Sister Anne had said, I was just selfish. I had no idea how I was going to raise my baby or even if, you know, I had nowhere to go after he was born. All I knew was that nobody would love my child as much as I did. And I was coming from a very primal place. So let me just pick up this scene on Boxing Day. I was called to Sister Anne's office and surprised to see Uncle Stan and Auntie Shirley huddled together. They were looking very distressed. Robbie's been killed was my first thought. Uncle Stan came over and took my hand. Oh, darling, what have you done? He asked with tears in his eyes. I know Peter shouldn't have been here, I said, but it's Christmas and we just... That's not why you're here, Sister Anne said sharply, cutting me off mid-sentence. You were seen over at the hotel buying alcohol and cigarettes, and that's strictly against the house rules. She was smirking as she fixed her gaze on me. Oh, what a relief. I almost laughed out loud. I looked at Uncle Stan, expecting a reaction to this ridiculous accusation, but he didn't respond. Uncle Stan, you know how ridiculous that is. Sister Anne obviously has me confused with someone else. My aversion to alcohol, and particularly smoking, was well known in our family, but until he started visiting me at St. Margaret's, I hadn't seen Uncle Stan for years. Perhaps he thought I'd changed. I stood there dumbfounded, waiting for him to say something. It was you, Sister Anne insisted, breaking the silence in the room. Turning to face her, I looked Sister Anne right in the eyes. It wasn't me, Sister. I don't smoke or drink alcohol. I saw you myself, coming back across the road, smoking and a cigarette, she said, adamantly. That's a lie, I replied. Dear Uncle Stan gasped, bringing his hand to his mouth. I knew that accusing a nun of lying would be close to sacrilege in Uncle Stan's mind. Or was he shocked finally to have realised that Sister Anne was accusing me of something so outrageous? In those days, Darlinghurst was a skid row area. The pub on Bourke Street opposite St. Margaret's was a slop shop, frequented by the lowest forms of society could dredge up. Every night through my open window, I could hear the drunken brawls and sounds of women being gangbanged in the alley. For Sister Anne to say she'd seen me coming back from such a place was laughable at best. But at 8 months pregnant, even she must have realised how ridiculous the accusation sounded. Now, dear, we can forget this whole incident if you sign these papers. Her voice became more conciliatory. But if you don't, you are going to be discharged immediately. She pushed the now tattered documents across the desk towards me. Ah, so this is what this is all about. Sister Anne clearly had no limits to the extent she was prepared to go to secure the consent to adopt my baby, even if it meant lies and extortion. My mind was racing, trying to think ahead to where this was all going. She can't take your baby without your signature. I heard the words in my head as if someone unseen had spoken them to me. I felt like I'd been given some kind of strength injection. For the first time in my life, I had power over my own life, and this gave me confidence to speak back. I've worked like a slave in this hospital for 4 months, and you are throwing me on the street because I won't give you my baby? Worked. You haven't worked. Miss Sinclair sent you back here because you refused to work. You're a lazy girl. There was nothing more to say. I wasn't going to sign the consent for adoption, no matter what she threatened me with. I glared at her. You'll go to hell, I screamed inside my head. Her eyes widened as if she was reading my mind. Uncle Stan and Auntie Shirley were unable to speak or move. I left the room without saying another word and went back to my dormitory to pack my things. In my rage, I nearly pulled over the wardrobe as I retrieved the baby clothes stuck to the back. Several girls saw me leaving with my suitcase. Where are you going? A girl I hardly knew asked me. I'm leaving because I won't sign the adoption papers. Oh, I thought you had to sign the papers to be able to have the baby here. She sounded surprised. You do. That's why I'm leaving. These bastards are not getting my baby.
Powerful. So powerful.
Well, you know, It was Christmas. I was 8 months pregnant. I was a week away from my 16th birthday, so legally I was still a child. And they were throwing me onto the street in a red light district with £20 or equivalent to $20 in my pocket. That's the lengths they were prepared to go to. Mm.
You're inspiring. So I understand the only names in the book that were changed to protect the privacy of the individuals, and that you otherwise named names. Sister Anne was the hospital administrator for St. Margaret's at that time, right?
Yes, she was. Look, it was important to the story that the perpetrators and the institutions were named. Otherwise, I could have been accused of making the whole thing up. A non-fiction book has to be just that, and it undergoes intense scrutiny and fact-checking before publication. I was able to provide proof of my confinement at St. Margaret's. Uncle Stan and Auntie Shirley were witnesses to the day I was thrown out of the hospital, and my medical records were also pretty damning, and if challenged, they could be produced.
So, for the next month, you're virtually under house arrest at the home of a family member, and had to wait until dark before you could go to the toilet.
Yes.
So the neighbors didn't see your condition. So a month later, you had to go back to the hospital to have the baby. That must have been terrifying.
Yeah, well, I tell you, we had an outside toilet at Uncle Les's, and having to pee in a bucket in the laundry and wait until after dark for a bowel movement was pretty uncomfortable. But yes, on the night I went into labour and I was being driven to St Margaret's by Uncle Les, it was a pretty scary time. My biggest fear was that they would drug me and tell me that the baby had died. There'd already been rumours at the home that this had happened to other girls.
So you have the baby. It's a horrific experience. But it was after the birth that things seems to get worse.
Well, it was clear that my son had already been promised to a wealthy couple on the waiting list. Perhaps money had already changed hands, because Sister Anne pulled out all stops. For the next 2 weeks, I was subjected to intimidation tactics and threats that went close to me taking my son to the top floor of the hospital and just jumping off. However, what they did to my newborn almost defies belief. When I was writing 10 Hail Marys and recalling all of these events in detail, I thought, oh, no one's going to believe this. So I wrote to the hospital and I asked for my medical records, and miraculously they were still available. I suspect this was only because they didn't know I was coming, because women trying to access these records subsequent to the publication of 10 Hail Marys have been told that their records have been destroyed. When I saw the medical records, and especially the feeding chart for my son, I just wept and wept. You know, for 3 days after his birth, while they had me drugged and unconscious, they gave him just enough fluid to keep him alive. And this was on the medical record. For, you know, they weren't even trying to conceal it, perhaps thinking that they'd never have to be answerable for it. And this, they also showed the alarming weight loss and the erratic pulse. And at this point, I was so bereft, I just stopped writing, and I entered a kind of grieving process and doubted that I was going to find the strength to continue.
Isn't that criminal?
Yes, my son would certainly, certainly is. It breaks all the laws of under the Human Rights Act. It certainly comes under torture. Mm.
Okay. I hope something's done about that. Would you feel comfortable reading this part of the story?
Let me just find a section here which will give you the impact of that. Let me go on page 28. Sam, I wasn't expecting that, but I'll just find a page.
Okay.
Now, bearing in mind here, I've just had the most horrific birthing experience, and after the baby's born, I do actually get to hear and see my son, but I was too weak to hold him, so they just held him up. I knew it was a boy, and then everything went black. They put a needle in my arm, and bang, I was unconscious. And I woke up 3 days later in a public ward.
Okay.
And, sorry. Sorry, listeners.
Take your time.
This is a pretty horrific thing.
It's pretty amazing. You know, that they could do something like that and get away with it. I just don't see how that can happen. It's horrible.
Okay, so I wake up and I'm screaming for my baby. Where's my baby? Bring me my baby. And I'm trying not to sound too confrontational. And the Sister Anne comes to my bed and she just ignores me and continues to proceed with all the reasons why adoption was the only option for unmarried mother, and shoves the adoption papers under my nose, and I smack them out of her hand and, scream at her, bring me my baby. Sister Anne scowled before turning sharply and leaving the ward. She returned a few minutes carrying a very distressed baby. "Sit up," she commanded. It took all my strength to move into a sitting position, and the pain shot right up my entire body. I felt like I was sitting on broken glass. She thrust a screaming bundle into my arms. "This isn't my baby," I said, searching his features, hoping to find some resemblance to the chubby, round-faced baby that had been handed to me after the birth. "Of course this is your baby. Now feed him." Sister Anne pulled the bindings from around my chest like she was trying to undo knotted rope. Adam's head thrashed around as he was picking up the scent, thinking I may have some milk to give him. I guided my nipple to his mouth and he latched on, sucking hard. The sharp pain caught me by surprise. I'd never been given any instruction on how to soften my nipples in preparation for breastfeeding. Unmarried girls were not supposed to keep their babies, so what would have been the point? After several agonising seconds, he pulled away, letting out even more intense screams. He drew his tiny legs up to his tummy and screamed until his face went purple and nothing was coming out. He was in agony, and there was nothing I could do to help him. "See, you can't even feed this child," Sister Anne sneered before pulling Adam from my arms. I could hear him screaming all the way down the corridor. This was torture for both me and my baby, a cruel tactic to make my baby ravenous and inconsolable with the intention of intimidating me into feeling incompetent. And it worked. I cried myself to sleep with Adam's pitiful sounds, wails ringing in my ears.
So, sorry. Horrible. So,
if I can just, what I should do here, Sam, if you don't mind, is that link this up with what happens, you know, just a couple of days after this. You know, in chapter 29, about 2 or 3 days after this event, and she comes to my bed every night with the paper. She's still trying to lay it on me about, you know, giving the baby
Kate,
up.
You were so undernourished. You couldn't even provide help for your
so
child.
I lost so much blood. I needed a transfusion, and I had 29 stitches in my crutch because the baby was literally – I was a little tiny girl. I was 16, and my baby was nearly 10 pounds. So it was just virtually ripped out of me. So I was ripped from, you know, one end to the other. Anyway, after all this and I still hadn't buckled, she comes to the ward and it's the day before I'm due to be or 2 days before I'm due to be discharged, and she says, you better listen to what I have to say. It was 2 days before I was due to be discharged. I was drifting off to sleep when Sister Anne appeared once again at my bedside. Thinking at first she was going to be more of the same, I turned my back to her. Her tone was more threatening than it had been, and I sat up to face her. I know your uncle isn't going to let you go back to his place with the baby, and I've contacted the Child Welfare Department and informed that you are a homeless, unmarried girl. If you have nowhere to go when you are to be discharged, they will take your baby. She was looking very smug, like we'd been playing some game of bluff, where she always knew she had the power and enjoyed watching me fool myself. You have two choices, child. You can either watch the welfare take your baby away and put him in a home, or you can do the right thing and sign the consent for adoption. We have a wonderful family waiting to take him. She put the documents on my bed and handed me a pen. I smacked it out of her hand with such force it rolled across the floor. I picked up the documents and tore the pages in half. I hated this woman with such an intensity I wanted to grab her by the throat and throttle the life out of her. This was not even about her winning anymore, because this was a lose-lose situation. She could not have cared about my son's welfare and to gloat about threatening to have the welfare take him away. At the very least, this was about punishment, although it did occur to me that she may have some other motive for wanting my son desperately. I didn't imagine that wealthy childless couples could adopt a newborn without some payment involved, perhaps even a payment in advance. So that gives you some idea of, you know, what it was like in those moments in that time in the hospital.
So after withstanding all the pressure to relinquish your son for adoption, and as if by divine intervention, help arrives, and you leave the hospital carrying your baby.
Yes,
I would have hoped that the happy ending, but it wasn't to be. You were forced into a loveless marriage, and you don't love him anymore, and he doesn't love you.
Well, I don't know that I loved him to start with. What, sex for a 15-year-old isn't really about love. It certainly wasn't in 1965. so I don't know if love really came into it, but there you go. No, we were not in love. And, you know, he knew I was having his child, and he was more than happy initially for me just to go away and have the baby adopted. But the thing is, my grandmother found out who he was and that he was an older boy, certainly older than me, I was 15 at the time and he was 19, and she was threatening to have him charged with carnal knowledge. It was a marriage of necessity for me because it put a roof over our heads, and it was also for him because carnal knowledge was a pretty serious crime and it carried a 3-year prison term. And once the police knew that we were getting married, the charges went away.
So just when I thought life would take a turn for the right direction for you, we get to chapter 36, and once again your whole world crumbles.
Well, Sam, I know this book is quite a roller coaster ride, but the last two chapters of 10 Hail Marys were by far the hardest for me to write. I had to almost detach myself from the process. It was a very painful process. At the same time, try to stay immersed so that the reader would come with me every step of the way. I liken it to holding my head underwater until my lungs were about to explode before coming up gasping for air. The circumstances that I was placed in at the time caused me to make a terrible decision that resulted in being separated from my son before he turned 2 and not see us reunited again for another 14 years.
How did you cope when you knew you had to leave your son behind?
Having to leave my son for even one day tore me to pieces. I can still remember the pain. I had no family, no money, and taking my son with me just wasn't an option. It was never my intention to leave him permanently. However, I was naive of the laws of the day and what happened when a woman voluntarily left the marriage.
An aspect of your writing that I find most engaging is your ability to describe the scene in such a way that I felt like I was right there beside you. Like right now, I'm sure everyone's listening going, oh my gosh. Not only could I empathize, I actually felt as if I was experiencing all of these events with you.
Well, that must have been pretty uncomfortable for you at times, I have to say.
Absolutely.
But that was precisely what I was hoping to achieve. I wanted the reader to come on this journey with me and not merely be a bystander.
Well, you achieved that with me, Kate.
Thank you, Sam.
So after all the betrayals and repeated abandonments, you were able to forgive and make the best of your life.
Well, you know, life is about choices, and one of the most valuable lessons in my life was to appreciate that success or failure is determined by good or bad decisions. And when you come to realize that, there really isn't any room for blame or hating others.
And it's a sign of true maturity to understand that you're responsible, you know, for the outcome of your life.
Yeah, it took me a few years to get to that place, but I finally got there. And when you do, then you were able to reconcile with those issues and come away, I hope, without the bitterness. I couldn't have written this story if I was still harbouring bitterness and resentment, because that would have come through in the writing, and I would have ended up in the misery genre somewhere, and I certainly didn't want that. I didn't want to be anyone to pity me. I don't see myself as a victim.
Yeah, you don't carry any victim qualities. You're definitely a strong woman. You mentioned that there were hundreds of young women who passed through the home in the time that you were there. Is there any explanation as to why so many young women were finding themselves in this predicament?
Well, there are certainly some theories about that. You know, 1960 saw a cultural revolution with the promotion of, in inverted commas, free love before laws allowed access to contraception and abortion. And the result was an unprecedented number of single pregnant women. This period was later referred to in papers as the bumper crop for adoptions. Now, by coincidence, the 1960s also saw an unprecedented number of infertile married couples. And this was thought to be caused by a worldwide epidemic of chlamydia, which is a sexually transmitted disease that went worldwide after World War II. And it became known as the silent epidemic because women could have this disease and not know they were infected. If left untreated in men or women, chlamydia causes infertility or other dangerous complications during pregnancy. You know, there were also married women at the home who found themselves pregnant while their husbands were away at sea or away in Vietnam, as was my experience, and they'd have their babies, have it adopted and go home, and no one was the wiser. The youngest girl at the home was just 11. She was a victim of the sexual abuse by her own father, who worked with a circus and dropped her off at the home on his way out of town. You know, there was no more pathetic sight than the poor little girl with a big belly holding her doll and crying for her mother. I should mention here that prior to the 1960s, adopting a child from an unmarried mother wasn't really considered an alternative to infertility. Young women who got pregnant outside wedlock were labelled bad seeds or fallen women, and the children they carried were considered to be the spawn of the devil, which perhaps is why the Child Adoption Act of 1939 was written in a way to encourage unmarried mothers to keep the child and made provision for financial support to assist her, because otherwise the child born to an unmarried mother was more than likely sent to an institution, a government-run institution or a church institution, and it's estimated that between 1990 and the 1980s, over 500,000 children were banged up in these institutions suffering unthinkable abuse, and they became known as the Forgotten Australians. By the mid-1960s, however, and more married couples finding it harder to conceive, perhaps for the reasons I've already mentioned, attitudes changed, and the clean slate theory was widely accepted when it came to adopting a child that had no genetic connection to either of the adopting parents. The clean slate theory was very convenient to help overcome the fears of potential adopting parents that they weren't going to take home, in inverted commas, a mentally retarded child, an expression often used to describe unmarried mothers in childcare training manuals.
What do you mean by clean slate theory?
Well, this theory, also called the tabula rasa, goes back to the ancient Persians. And put simply, it's a belief that a newborn child's brain is like a clean slate, nothing's written on it, and that life's experiences, rather than genetic inheritance, will determine the characteristics of the child. Wealthy childless couples were prepared to pay big money for a beautiful, perfectly healthy newborn onto which they could write their own story. Sadly, it didn't always turn out like this, and when adopted children started to show characteristics that neither adoptive parent could relate to, the child was sometimes abused, tossed out of the home, or sent to an institution. One hopes that most adopted children found loving homes and families, but sadly too many were physically abused, ended up too well represented on the lists of prison inmates, suicides, and of course asylums.
Huh. I understand that the Catholic Church and other institutions issued formal apologies for the role they played in the practice of forced adoption, and that the government of Australia also gave a formal apology that was read in Parliament by the then Prime Minister Julia Gillard.
Yes, there have been apologies from the Catholic Church and other institutions, even individuals like doctors and lawyers, who played a part in the forced adoption practices of the time. For many of the victims, an apology is all that they required. Others, however, are pushing for victim compensation, which I think is fair enough. Individuals proven to have broken the law, resulting in an injury or suffering, don't get to walk away scot-free, and neither should powerful institutions, in my mind.
So why do you think it took over 10 years between the first inquiry and the second to get public attention that led to the churches and the government issuing following formal apologies?
Well, my thought is that this issue after the first inquiry was just simply too hot to handle. You know, it implicated the Catholic Church, big, powerful institutions, lawyers, you know, doctors. It was just swept under the rug. It's been, oh, God, don't touch this. You know, victims of these crimes were unmarried mothers at the time, when this alone was a very shameful situation and a secret that most of them kept well hidden. At the first hearing into adoption practices in New South Wales, the women who did come forward to give evidence were shouted down, spat at, and told to go away, you signed a consent for adoption. Well, that was true. Most of the mothers did sign the consent. However, it wasn't an informed consent. And it was often obtained when the mother was in a drug-induced state, which makes the consent invalid. In some cases, signatures were even forged. And in extreme cases, babies were taken away and the mother was told the baby had died.
How do you feel knowing that your book has shown a spotlight onto issues that many would have wished stayed swept under the rug?
They say, Sam, and I agree, success is always the sweetest form of revenge.
Yeah, you've covered that.
See, I'm not a saint.
Well,
far from it.
Given that 10 Hail Marys wasn't published until after your 60th birthday, what kept you from writing sooner?
Well, that's a good question. I suppose losing my son the way I did left me with such a burden of guilt and shame that in order to survive, I had to totally reinvent myself, even giving myself a new name. For the next 14 years, my entire focus was on pulling myself out of poverty that contributed to the situation. Firstly, I had to make up for the lack of formal education and acquire skills and training that would equip me to move up the ladder of success. To a place where I could, where my son would be proud and where I could have the financial strength, if necessary, to kick in the doors that kept us apart. This story is told in the next book, Settling Day, which is due for release in March next year. Settling Day was in fact the first book I wrote, which I began following the fall from a train that turned my whole world upside down and left me housebound and confined to a wheelchair. When I gave the completed manuscript to my trusted friend, John, to read, he asked me why I had glossed over the time I spent in St. Margaret's Home for Unwed Mothers. My reply was pretty flippant, and I said, I kept the baby. Where's the story in that? Due to my personal circumstances, I'd been unaware that the parliamentary inquiry into adoption practices in New South Wales had taken place, and John gave me the link to access the final report from the internet. It remained unread but saved for future reference because around the same time, I learned of the magnitude of the losses I'd suffered at the hands of cunning and unscrupulous business associates, and this began a fight for justice that would take 4 years of my life and leave me emotionally and financially drained.
Well, Kate, we're actually winding down. Our time has flown by. And
well, it's been a joy, Sam. I hope you've enjoyed our chat. I certainly have. I could talk all day on this.
I want everyone to know that 10 Hail Marys is available at thebookrepository.com. It's free postage anywhere in the world. And you can always get it from amazon.com. I am glad you all joined us with Kate Howarth. It's been a complete pleasure, Kate, and I'm sure that everyone wants to know more about this book and more about your book to come. I have to say that your book was incredible and very compelling, a true roller coaster, but something that has to be read and should be read by everyone.
Well, thank you, Sam. I'm hoping to get a release of the book in North America next year when the sequel is published, so we may actually get to meet. That'll be something I can certainly look forward to.
I look forward to that too. Thank you for joining us on The People Speak on BBS Radio. Thank you.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people and they stood there hungry. Stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water. Yeah, this land is made for you.